Our next speaker
is Dr. Mark Weinstein, and I just had your biographical sketch and promptly buried it. Darn it. Okay, there we go. Sorry. Mark has his PhD from MIT in 1996 and is Associate Professor of Adult Education and Human Resource Development in the College of Education at Florida International University. He's been engaged in a number of NIOSH-sponsored research practice initiatives and has published in a wide range of journals. He's currently collaborating with someone at the Center to Protect Workers' Rights on a project to promote local exhaust ventilation in construction and using a three-dimensional multi-user virtual and learning environment to support the Youth at Work curriculum developed by Labor Occupational Health Program at Berkeley. So you have your choice about having the mouse. Okay, keyboard, and here's some water for you if you like.
Okay, thank you. And you could tell how I need to update that bio because CPWR is now the Construction Institute for Research and Training, no longer the Center to Protect Workers' Rights. And as Mary mentioned, I've been fortunate to have worked on a number of sponsored projects. This, however, what I'll be showing you is pretty much unfunded. It's sweat equity, except for what we did receive a small amount of money, less than $3,000 from the Educational Information Division at NIOSH, to experiment with this platform. Now, what Jenny is doing is great and inspiring, and I'm glad that I met her here today. What I'm going to show you today is not quite ready for prime time. We do have a grant proposal pending with NIOSH to fully develop it, but it's under the R21 program. So I anticipate, and I'll explain why it's not quite ready for prime time, but I'm also hopeful that one day we'll be there. Some disclosures. Ruba, who's my doctoral student, who's been working on this, she's a middle school teacher, and I don't have any relationships, but if somebody wants to give us money, I'm happy to disclose it. Okay. So, what we have here is some snapshots of a virtual restaurant. You are welcome to visit it. While I'm showing you static two-dimensional pictures, it's important to realize that this is a three-dimensional environment. Any of you who are gamers, and there are probably not too many out there, but if we were with teenagers, we would have quite a few people who would be into World of Warcraft. It's the same idea. It's a multi-user space. So individuals enter this space simultaneously, and they can interact in multiple modalities that I'll explain. Now, what's really key about this, and I'll go into a little bit about sort of the platform towards the end of the presentation, is every artifact that you see is user-created. Every sign, every pebble. So essentially what you need to conceptualize this platform as, and this is built on Second Life, is this is the 3D internet. So just as a 2D internet allows people to create websites of anything they want, this is the same idea, except it adds dimensionality. It's also important to recognize that it's completely immersive insofar as there's sound that's stereophonic, so you can hear people walking up behind you and it gets louder as they approach. There's also many different ways to communicate. This is not meant to substitute any existing efforts. We're fortunate to stand on the shoulders of many people who've been working on teen safety. And one of the disclaimers I have to add very quickly is I am not a content specialist in safety and health. I have lots of colleagues who are, and I call them all the time. I'm making more of those colleagues every day. I'm a social scientist by training, and I stumbled into this idea because I was posed with a challenge a year ago last June to do something online. Have any of you taught online? Have any of you avoided teaching online? Well, those of you who avoid teaching online might want to avoid it because it seems like we're going backwards in time, at least with the poorly designed online instruction. It's like the old correspondence courses. You see something, you download it, you respond to it, you send it off to an instructor, they respond, and it goes back there, but you really don't have a sense of presence unless it's really a well-designed course and the instructor's always in the chat room. And so as I was challenged to develop an online course, I had to figure out why I disliked teaching online and what I could do about it. And I stumbled into a number of books, and One is called The Making, Coming of Age in Second Life, which is a play on the title Coming of Age in Samoa by Margaret Mead. Of course, the main takeaway from that book is you have to understand cultures on their own terms. So you don't go to faraway places and go, ooh, these people are cannibals. You might say, what is the meaning of cannibalism to a particular society? So prior to even entering this world, I knew that this was more than a platform, because a lot of people, and I'll show you one or two of them, this is an extension of their real life. And if you approach your interactions with them as these people are somehow deviant, that they spend more time in Second Life and have Second Life relationships that are deeper and more profound than the real life relationships, you're not going to do very well in working in this environment. And one of the people I'll show you here is Pamela Clift. Pamela Clift is a programmer extraordinaire. I met her in Second Life. I attended a lecture and we spoke. And what we have here is a typo. What we really should have here is this model of immersive learning that is being used in people who study Second Life. And it has three components. It's teacher presence, learner presence, and that big wheel, that should be social presence. And the idea of this environment is that learning really takes place when all three components are there. And you could think about how standard online education might not provide that. And while I like the flash videos, they still are sort of single-person shooter, right? You know, there's one person and a computer, so there's not a lot of social presence there because it's not a real person behind you. By contrast, when you go into this environment, and I invite you there, you will talk to other people. You will pick up objects. You will be able to do lots of things, including simulations. And there's multiple ways to communicate. I like it because, I don't know about you, but when I teach undergraduates, no matter how compelling I make my presentations, at least I think they're compelling, my students are texting, they're doing all types of things, they're going online, they're doing lots of things other than listening to me. When I use this in instruction, I have used this in my graduate seminars, you have multiple modalities to communicate with people. So, for instance, there's Shauna, she's another student of mine. So if I wanted to speak to Shauna, we have the ability to have voice back and forth. If I want to have a private conversation with Shauna that no one else could hear, I can make a private telephone call. And when we make a private telephone calls, our lips don't move. But when we're speaking to us, our lips do move. Also, it's important to understand that you have multiple camera angles. So you could sort of scan the entire environment. You could zoom in. So I could zoom in close and watch Shauna's lips move. I could also just simply text Shauna. And again, that has two modalities. There's the public texting. So everybody within 30 virtual yards will hear or see the texting or hear my voice. However, if I want a private conversation with Shauna, I would send her a private note, and that she would receive it, but nobody would be able to see it with her, except for her. Here's Shauna again in the back area where we have a kitchen. And while we haven't built these elements into this yet, you could identify various hazards here. And so, of course, you could develop all types of games around this, including treasure hunts or simply hazard identification activities. And if you were to click the knife, for instance, you would receive a note card, and that note card would then go into the learner's inventory. And there's a very complex way that students, kids, adults, avatars could keep things in their inventory, including appropriate clothing to wear at work. We have an issue with that at Florida International University, and we joke about it, dress codes for avatars. And when I mention that to my students, they say, well, we don't have dress codes for our students. Why should we have dress codes for our avatars? But in any case, you know, Shauna has a whole inventory, so all she has to do with the click of a button is change into a waitress outfit or change into a chef outfit. And this, of course, could be integrated into any type of learning activity around appropriate dress for work, especially in a restaurant. You don't want long hanging sleeves over the stove front or anything like that. Again, this was in the background, so you could see there's a little poster back there. There's a couple dish rags there that might be part of a hazard identification. You know, you shouldn't have sort of dirty towels lying around a kitchen area necessarily. But you can also sort of zoom in, get a really nice look at this. And also what's critically important here is that all these objects could be dynamically moved. So this particular truck has a button where the lift goes down. We could put lots of things in it. We could accommodate lots of people simultaneously. What we envision eventually is having an entire island, which would be able to accommodate 100 learners simultaneously. But before getting into that, let me just walk through a couple other slides. Here's just an example of something else that could be done. This is not legible, readable in this format. However, if a student clicks it, they will get a PDF of this poster. It just goes to their inventory, and then they can further download it onto their computer. Another nice aspect of it is that we could incorporate other things. So right here is the back area. It's a little dark, and my head's tilted here. But these are chairs, and what you see is that video screen there. Well, that video screen is actually, it's just a snapshot of it, but it's streaming a video. So we could take Georgia Tech's videos, and we could queue them up, and the students could sit in their chairs, and they could watch the video as well in the environment. We could do PowerPoint presentations at the same time. I can't say, because I haven't tried whether or not we can incorporate the flash games, but trust me, after this presentation, I'm going to give Jenny a call, and we're going to try to put some of these there. Now, what I've showed you so far is available. I'll give you the link. The way you enter this world is through a browser. It's a Second Life browser, and there's a Second Life address that you could just go into. You have to register, but it's free. But we do have, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, a pending R21 proposal where we plan to sort of really build this out. And this is just a subset of the things that we're proposing to do. So the idea basically is we would purchase an entire island. What's an island? Well, an island is a server that's somewhere in Silicon Valley. One server gives us 16 virtual acres, which is an enormous capacity. We've built this cafe here on a quarter acre. Okay, so you can see how you have multiple objects. We anticipate to have like a team safety gym. Now, that has nothing to do with safety, but that will be a gym where the kids learn how to operate their avatars. Because, it's fun. We want it to be fun. And then, in addition, we're going to have a teen safety museum. And the kids could walk through the museum, and they'll be able to click on different exhibits and learn about labor history. We'll have a teen safety mall, which will actually be a series of storefronts with hazard identification activities. We have a teen safety memorial envisioned. You can imagine, this could be really moving because this environment is visually attractive. We could do a lot with it. And you could essentially, almost like a holodeck, click a button, and then a speaker could appear, a video could appear, could tell the history of someone who was hurt or killed at work. Really, there's, really endless possibilities. Now, to sort of understand, and this is where I have to... Good, and I want to say yes to this. Now, this might jump me to a second slide here, but this is just a quick snapshot. Now, when you go online and you download this video and you hyperlink, this is, you're going to see this page here. And then all you have to do is click it, and you could go to that location, and you could go into our world and help us figure out this platform. I want to emphasize again that this is done on a shoestring budget right now. So everything you're seeing has been done with about 25 hours of programming. So, when you have a really good programmer like I have with Pamela, we could get a lot done very quickly. Now, the final thing I want to show you here is a video, and this video isn't of our world, but it's a video of somebody building an artifact in Second Life, because we also believe there's some residual values here. And the residual value is that the kids actually can learn some programming skills. And the other thing I want to mention is that it has this open source dimension to it. So if somebody comes up to me and says, hey, I want to build this simulation so that we could work with students on issues of, dealing with unwanted sexual advances, I'll have to say, sure. Go ahead and do it. Let me go ahead and get this going. Of course, you won't have the music with it, but what you'll see here is somebody who's an avatar. You'll see his avatar, and through clicks of the button, he's going to build the guitar from scratch for Suzanne Vega. So, you start with a basic box, which is called a prim, and then using a series of CAD-like programming tools, you reshape it. So, I mean, I would hope that if we really get this going, we would have kids doing this on their own and building artifacts on their own. We could also imagine a circumstance where you would have teen safety officers. These might be those with more experience who could help other kids go through this environment. Now, of course, in building Bumble's Cafe, we didn't build everything from scratch. We, you know, purchased or had in inventories prefabricated artifacts. But I think this shows you the power of the platform, just a series of mouse clicks and such. Excuse me? That's a good question. This doesn't. This I'm just trying to show you how to program in Second Life. So this is just a demo. I tried to get something time-lapsed of our building Bumble's Cafe to demonstrate how you build it from scratch. I couldn't do it, didn't quite have enough time. So this is instead just a time-lapse of somebody else building a guitar, just for demonstration purposes, to give you a sense of the robustness of the platform. So with my timer up, I just want to do a few things here. This is the book I mentioned, Coming of Age in Second Life. This is a terrific anthropology of Second Life. Tom Bolstroff is an accomplished anthropologist. He has two worlds. He writes about Second Life and Second Life culture. He also writes about sexual minorities in Indonesia. I'm not quite so sure how he combined those two. And I also want to give a special thanks to a number of people. Diane Bush, who I had a lot of conversations with about this idea and this general labor occupational health program at Berkeley. Pamela Clift, our avatar extraordinaire, and the Education Information Division at NIOSH. And again, through this platform, you could come into this world. Send me an email. I'll show you around, and perhaps you'll give me a few ideas. Thank you.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left in this session, but why don't we give Mark the opportunity to have a few questions here, and then at the same time, I'll have the other presenters come on up and have a seat, and we can just, people have different questions for them or discussion points, or you can stay where you are, wherever, whatever, you know. Anybody with a question for Mark right off?
Oh, yes.
Mark, how do you anticipate something like this being used? Is part of a curriculum or?
Okay, the way I anticipate it being used, and the way we wrote it up in the R21, is for this to essentially have all the knowledge content elements of the full-scale curriculum. So the idea being that in a classroom where you have high-stake testing and limited curriculum time, there's still downtime for students. So the idea is when students have downtime, because, you know, for whatever reasons, the instructor is working with a smaller group of students, you could send somebody to a lab. And through the computer lab, they enter this world. And then, depending on where they are, we would have, you know, elements of self-directed activity and teacher-moderated activities. And what we would anticipate following the development is some type of quasi-experimental design where we run people through a standard online curriculum versus this. But that would be 3-4 years out. First, we have to develop it. And the advantage here is you could have an instructor or a resource person. That person could be in Ontario, could be in Sweden, could be wherever. And the students as well could be from wherever, not from one school. And we could, with current technology, we could accommodate about 100 learners simultaneously.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
identify yourself.
Hi, Mark Blakeman from Georgia Tech as well. I know there's a lot of infrastructure already in Second Life. I wonder if something like this could be used where a student would go in and say they wanted to become a bomb demolition technician. Then they would need to go to the safety site
Sure. You know, with 16 acres, we have a lot of possibilities. And again, I have to emphasize the open source nature of this means that for just $3,000, I could rent an island for a year and have all the programming elements out there. And then anybody could use it. You know, I probably would have some administrative control to make sure there's nothing inappropriate, but, you know, we're dealing with educators. I don't anticipate great problems with this. So I do think these are really sort of limitless possibilities, but there are also limitations, including bandwidth limitations, including that Miami-Dade, where I'm working with right now, they block this site. You know, so, you know, we're still a little ways away from that, but you have a sense of how it could be used. Also, there is some pretty good research out there showing that, indeed, this, you know, issue of being able to combine learner presence, social presence, and teacher presence is quite powerful. It really does capture people in a way that it's hard to describe if you haven't experimented with it. I'm sorry, what was your question? Yeah. Well, we haven't, you know, the question is this online peer-to-peer counseling? It could be. It really is up to how one does it. Now, so the conversations I was having with Diane Bush was, to what extent could we make this entirely self-directed activities without having a teacher there? And I worked for a couple weeks trying to figure that out, and in the end I said, you know, if we're going to do this right, we need some instructors there. I do believe that there is going to be a lot of peer-to-peer learning, but in the form of simulation. So one simulation we imagine is running people through a series of hazard identification activities and then have the boss of the restaurant tell kids to do things, and we would scaffold it to things that they shouldn't do and then hope to have the kids come together as they run into each other and say, hey, they want us to do this. What do you think about that? How do we handle it? You know. So in that sense, if you think simulation has an element of peer-to-peer learning, I would say this does.